Although Latin is often referred to as a dead language, it continues to be used in a variety of ways. And according to Nicholas Osler, it could be making a comeback today with 2.5 million pages in Latin in the Internet. Mr. Osler is a linguist and author of the book Ad Infinitum, a biography of Latin. It's published by Walker Books. I'm pleased it has brought him to the show today. Hello.
Well, thank you.
What are Latin's origins? Does it begin with the creation of Rome?
Well, that's the earliest information we have about it. Of course, with comparative linguistics, we have found inscriptions all around Italy in languages like Oscan and Umbrian, which are like Latin, but different from it, about as different from it as, say, Spanish is from Portuguese. So it looks like Latin was one of a number of, you could call them dialects, which took over the center and south of Italy.
Because Etruscan was spoken by a lot more people than Latin, wasn't it, initially?
It was. Initially, that's right. Etruria, or Tuscany, was the area to the north, really, of Latium, or Latium, the area where Latin became the standard language. And that's a very interesting language because it doesn't seem to be related to anything else in the Italian area, whereas Latin is related to all these languages to its south, and also, interestingly, to Venetic up in the Venetian area, up in the northeast of the Italian landmass. Etruscan was all on its own, and yet somehow above and more advanced than all the other languages of Italy. And this, we're talking about the 8th, 7th, 6th centuries BC when we're talking about that.
So, but Latin winds up winning out.
Yes, somehow it did. It seems that the Etruscans were much more interested in culture and trade and only pursued imperial military schemes in order to guarantee that. The Romans, on the other hand, although they were certainly prepared to take a fair amount of constitutional baggage from the Etruscans, things like the fasces, the rods and the axes, the imperial purple is an Etruscan idea.
Later adapted by Mussolini.
Indeed, all that stuff. And indeed, even circus games seem to have come to the Romans from the Etruscans. Nevertheless, they were much more, in a way, down-to-earth and practical. They were farmers, and they were soldiers, and whenever they won a war, they took over land, and that was the secret of their advance.
But you're suggesting that Roman imperial gains were the big difference, and I guess it's like what happened with the British Empire. The British went in, they spoke English, and if you wanted to succeed, you were Indian or you were Nigerian or whatever, you learned to speak English.
Well, it's sort of interesting. The two strategies are both represented in the British Empire. In this continent, the English came and they settled. And that was like what the Romans did after they waged wars, and especially when people retired from the army, they would be settled in land grants all round what became the Roman Empire. And that meant that Latin took over. In other parts, however, in the case of Britain, talking as a Briton here, we discourage settlement, and that was certainly the case in India because it was being taken over just after we had been kicked out of North America, or the best part of North America as we saw it. And so we ended up being a mercantile power to start with in India, which gradually took over. And that's had a different effect on the language in India, perhaps in the same way that the Etruscan language was not so spread about in Italy because they didn't settle. They were interested in setting up trading posts, getting the wealth, but not taking over and coming to stay.
But if you were somebody in one of the Roman colonies, you had to learn to speak Latin, didn't you, if you wanted to succeed?
Did you have to? Nobody was made to, but if you were the elite, you would want to because it meant you could get ahead in this bigger and more integrated world that the Romans were dragging you into, kicking or screaming. But in the Eastern Mediterranean, interestingly, nobody ever felt the need to really get into Latin. They felt they had all the advantages of civilization before the Romans got there. They could teach the Romans a thing or two, but they didn't really think they could learn much from the Romans. They weren't being offered anything in the way of democracy or a political freedom, which they had originally thought they might get out of the Roman domination. And so ultimately, they sort of sat back, got on with their culture, were prepared to accept worship of Rome as a deity. They quite liked the idea of having a cult of the emperor and things like that. Those sort of things caught on rather well in the Greek part of the empire. But the language was not used except in law courts and in the army.
You say that Latin wasn't a literary language at the beginning. So it was just a language of function?
Yes. I mean, people spoke it. They did the sort of things which you might expect. When they learnt to read and write from the Etruscans, they did things like setting up epitaphs to their ancestors. And they probably did a certain amount of correspondence in it. Advertising is always an early thing in literacy. But they didn't really get into literature until just about the time that they were turning their attentions to spreading their power in the east of the Mediterranean. And then they started translating Greek classics, particularly comedy, in a big way.
Did they have to adjust the language to make it more literary?
Yes. Well, they borrowed a lot of words from Greek. There's a famous example of... There's an awful lot of back chat between slaves in Roman and Greek comedies. And somebody's called a graphicus servus, which is graphicus is Greek from the word for a picture. So it's a picture-perfect slave. And Roman comedy is full of all this Greek vocabulary, which it's difficult to know whether it was more characteristic of learned people or of slaves. But anyway, it was evidently went down very well on the stage and brought big laughs.
My guest is Nicholas Osler, author of Empires of the Word, A Language History of the World, and chairman of the Foundation for Endangered Languages. His latest book is called Ad Infinitum, A Biography of Latin. It's published by Walker. Well, when Christianity came along, the Gospels had been written in Greek. Why did the Catholic Church decide to adopt Latin as its official language?
Well, the center of Christianity had moved to Rome, or at least one of the major centers had become Rome. And of course, that meant it was bang next door to the Roman political establishment at the time, since the Roman Empire in the 3rd century was still centered on Rome. Now, there were some attempts to vernacularize the faith because, after all, it was spreading mostly among lower-class people who typically wouldn't have been educated in Greek. But, as I just mentioned, maybe slaves tended to know Greek anyway, so there was a sort of ambiguity there. Nevertheless, people felt that speaking and praying in the vernacular was ultimately more authentic and likely to reach more people.
And the vernacular in this case was Latin.
The vernacular was indeed Latin. But then the politics raised its effective head in the fact that there was a dynastic dispute as to who would be in control of the Roman Empire in the middle of the 4th century AD. And Constantine, coming down from Britain, needed to find something which would give him some sort of special clout in representing himself as an important contender for the throne, or in fact the legitimate one. His opponent at the time appealed to the Sibylline books, and this was the traditional Roman way of showing that the gods were on your side. He said, well, I need something like this. And he seems to have been brought up in a Christian context. He thought of appealing to Christ, and so he put the Cairo, which was the symbol of Christianity in those days, on the shields of all his soldiers, and they fought the great battle of the Milvian Bridge and won it in the name of Christ. And the bishops were very quick to jump on the significance of this. They became an important players in the empire after that. And although there were certain difficulties attending with having a religion like Christianity as the state religion, they were quite prepared to overlook those.
How did Latin start breaking up into vernacular variants? Was that a slow process?
Well, probably. I mean, because it takes generations and generations to create a new language, and yet 6 or 7 new languages were created in the west of Europe. I think we should look at this, really, as the long-term effect of the Germanic invasions, which came in the 5th century AD. And you might say, why didn't it end up with people speaking Germanic languages? To some extent, you could say that the fact that French is different from Italian or Spanish has to do with Germanic influence. But what seems to have happened is that the prestige of Latin was so great, and indeed the strength of Latin reinforced by the Roman Catholic Church was so great, that Gothic and Vandal German, which were used as ecclesiastical languages themselves, never really got a look in. So
but
what happened
was... Wasn't there some Latin that permeated the Germanic languages?
Well, it came in, but later on, I would say. Not really at this point. It was more... Here were the Germanic people coming in. They wanted to be part of the empire. The empire didn't collapse as a result of people rebelling against it, but rather the fact that they were somehow swamped by people from the outside coming in. And the effect was to break down internal communications within the Roman Empire. And the result, when you don't get communications, people don't move around, swap stories and prayers and whatever else as they go around. You find that the languages go off in different directions.
So was official Latin totally lost, or was it still being used side by side with these new vernacular versions?
Yes. The amazing thing about Latin is that the tradition which reproduced it, which was a school tradition which had been set up in the time of St. Augustine and earlier, in fact, never stopped. There are 80 generations of transmission of Latin from teacher to pupil. And that's vast. I mean, that's... English has only been a significant language for 20 generations.
But I would assume that Latin has remained a viable language mainly because of the Catholic Church.
Well, the Catholic Church did an awful lot for Latin, as well as holding the providing a sort of ideology of the empire after the breakdown of the civil power. It also went on with this process of sending missionaries to remote parts of Europe where the Roman legions had never been, and places like Hungary and Germany and Ireland and the north of Scotland were all reached by these missionaries who brought Latin with them in a way that Roman power never could.
Now, Latin was taught, Latin and sometimes Greek were taught in even New York's public schools, but that's no longer the case. Yet, it seems to have survived. You call Latin a dormant language. So it's not an endangered language, even though your organization is about, is the Foundation for Endangered Languages. Is it in danger of becoming endangered?
Well, it's a difficult way to look at it, isn't it? Because it's existed... certainly since the 17th century, it's only really been a language for glorying in its past. There hasn't been original thought being developed in Latin, although a lot of people have said that it's good to hang on to Latin in order to keep in touch with the European tradition. As I said, it's a very old and honourable tradition. At the same time, there are all these languages which are derived from Latin, from French through to Portuguese and Romanian in the East, which have continued as lively modern languages. So in a sense, if Latin is dead, it has died and gone to heaven, because if you add together all the populations of all those Romance languages, it turns out to be the second biggest language community in the world today.
But it has to be held in its pure state or else it becomes something else. What about the other endangered languages? You speak a number of them. How do you keep an endangered language from becoming a dead language?
Well, it's all a matter of morale, really.
Not about creating dictionaries and insisting that somebody keep on speaking the language?
Well, there are these technical aids which are needed in order that people can actually know what their language has been if it hasn't been passed on to them through learning it in their own home environment. There are going to need things like dictionaries and grammars to be written, but then you're going to need a certain sort of linguist who can interpret those documents in a way that makes them usable again. Ultimately, a language will only survive if there are people who want to speak it. They must consciously want to speak it because it's hard work.
How many of them do you speak?
Well, I have dabbled, I would say, and sometimes done important work in say, 18 different languages.
Mostly endangered.
No, mostly the big languages that one knows about. In terms of endangered languages, my repertoire is much more restricted. I know a little bit of Irish, which is could be my ancestral language, and Chibcha is a defunct language of northern South America.
Ad Infinitum, A Biography of Latin, is Nicholas Osler's latest book. It's published by Walker. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you indeed.